And now is the time for the message. So I invite you to settle in, settle your hearts and your minds, and just listen. Take in what you need and discard what you do not. But listen. Now, I have been receiving this week rather a lot of phone calls. They're random calls. Those random calls we get sometimes from marketing firms asking benign and sometimes intrusive questions. Or those sometimes more disturbing calls wanting to scam their fellow humans by pretending to be Revenue Canada or a relative needing help. But the calls this week were different. It was a voice speaking in a language I did not understand. Obviously still a robocall, but a robocall I could make neither head nor tail of. Now, of course, I blocked the caller after the fifth such call. But it got me to thinking about preaching and about the readings that we read every week, about the ink spilled and the voice expended on carrying on this ancient calling of what is described as being in every minister's portfolio, the delivery of word and of sacrament and of pastoral care. Now, ministry of the word became an academic designation a long time ago. Ordination became a combination of pastoral suitability and academic proficiency. And pulpits rose from the floor to the ceiling, and sermons got longer and longer, and doctrines abounded, and the gulf between the laity understanding and the clergy understanding grew wider. And Jesus would have been flabbergasted, as he would have regarded much of what ministry has become today, as I heard on the voice down my phone line. He would have regarded much of what ministry has become as incomprehensible. By story and by the relating of personal experience, by passionate pastoral care and sharing in the experience of one another, one another's struggles and moments of clarity, the preacher is actually at their best when the room, the space, the permission is found for the spirit that undergirded and filled Jesus to move under all the layers and all the noise of living this human life. Speaking, giving one's best effort every week to do this, is the work of the preacher. It is not the role of a cheerleader or a dictator. It is the role of a facilitator and companion. It is not the role of arbiter in order to prescribe or prescribe the actions of another, but it is the role of nudging, exploring, sharing, to recognize and accept the presence of the Spirit in the hearer's life so that we are better equipped to be our own arbiter. So let's be off on this day's journey with Jacob and on this day's journey with Jesus. Let's mine the text together with this in mind this morning. Now, the title of today's message is Sufficient Unto All Days. Now, first to the Genesis passage that Michael read for us. This contains much of what is really, really ancient, and much that is just ancient, and much that is rather new. It reads on so many different levels. On the level of history, it is full of references to pre-Israelite cultic material. It is plunked down in the middle of the patriarchal history of the Hebrew Bible, and particularly in the story of the patriarch Jacob. And it is utterly timeless in its theme and its appeal. We all have dark nights of the soul. We all have our own metaphysical struggles with who God is, what God is, with ourselves, with our actions and our conceptions of right and wrong, of meaning and of purpose. We are right there with you, Jacob, right there in the midst of this story. We can relate to this story. So let's tell it. Our passage is part of the larger story of Jacob and Esau that we have been reading this month. Our story of Jacob's struggle beside the Jabbok River is plunked right down in the middle of the increasingly tense story about Jacob's impending meeting with his brother Esau, whom many years ago he tricked out of his birthright and his inheritance, and whom Jacob is sure will kill him. 20 years before the incident recorded in today's reading, Jacob had fled his father's home. He left with the clothes on his back, a bartered birthright, and a stolen blessing. Jacob fled to the land of Haran, and there he practiced his art of trickery on his father-in-law, who was also rather tricky, and duped Jacob into marrying the wrong sister. Although last week we heard a different interpretation where it was actually Rachel who duped Jacob. We can read these stories very different ways. Now, after 20 years and 2 wives and 11 children, he fled his father-in-law's house and decided to return to his homeland because he had a dream telling him to do so. Now, of course, Jacob is mortally afraid to return home. He must face his brother Esau, the very brother he cheated and stole from, and who has every reason to hate him. Jacob is afraid, so the tension in this story begins to build as Jacob makes the journey toward home. He sends a messenger to tell Esau he is on his way and that he is now very wealthy. The messenger returns and tells Jacob that his brother is coming out to meet him and that he is bringing 400 men with him. This does not sound like good news for Jacob. So he divides everything he has into 2 camps, so that if Esau attacks one, the other will have some hope of escaping. And then he prays. And then he sends gifts of livestock 5 times, each a little after the other, hoping to appease his brother. And the tension builds. And Jacob sends his 2 wives, 2 concubines, 11 sons, and all his possessions across a river, and then night falls. And Jacob is left totally alone on one side of the river. And a man wrestles with him until daybreak. And Jacob is able to hold on to the man and not be overpowered. And so the man wounds him in the hip, but Jacob still does not let go. And the man asks to be let go because day is breaking, and Jacob still refuses to let go until he is granted a blessing. And the man asks Jacob his name and renames him Israel. And Jacob asks the man his name, to which he replies, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And then the man grants the blessing and the sun rises. And Jacob names this place Penuel, which means the face of God. We are left with a Jacob exhausted from his struggle, yet blessed, and given a new name, the hand of God, who has yet to lay eyes on his brother. Now, I would challenge any writer of any time, to come up with a more dramatic or intense storyline. And is this not all of our stories, at least in part, minus, of course, the concubines and multiple wives and lots else that are details in the story. But it is part of our story. We seem hell-bent in this life to know the end of it. We seem hell-bent in this life to insist on being right. We seem hell-bent in this life on figuring it all out, finding neat little pigeonholes of definition for that which cannot be defined, solving the problem of life and of death and of all in between rather than actually living it. But this does not mean we should not seek, because I am firmly convinced there is an answer. And I'm going to relate to you mine for my own journey, and it is very different for every soul. But I think it has this common characteristic. It is sufficient unto all our days. It is the answer that makes the struggle necessary, and the answer that eventually makes the struggle not necessary. And it is the answer that allows the Spirit to move within and to recognize the Spirit in all else all around. Now, you might recognize the title of the sermon as part of a line from the Sermon on the Mount from Matthew, taken from the poetic King James Version of the Bible. "Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof," is what it says. Jesus is telling the listeners not to worry about tomorrow, that it will bring its own trouble. And I would like to turn that on its head this morning and declare this to be true and part of the answer to which I have arrived. sufficient unto the day is the goodness thereof. Now, first, a little history, or as the theologians like to put it, exegesis. The Old Testament is not an independent book that can be interpreted on its own. It obviously did not spring from the writing of any one person. On the contrary, these books from Genesis to Joshua are a huge connected narrative made up of a lot of individual narratives. Story of creation, of Abraham and Sarah, the story of Jacob and Esau. Together, they make up the whole that arose when the final editors skillfully combined these individual sources. Why, the book of Genesis is thought to have been a combination of three documents. Our passage is thought to have been part of the oldest source dating to some 3,000 years ago, about 950 before the Common Era. Now, as old as this narrative is, and I pointed out that this was really ancient, it draws on even older tales. This exchange between the man and Jacob is fascinating. How close this story is to all the ancient sagas, stories which have come down to us in one form or another, in which gods or spirits or demons attack a man, and in which then the man extorts something of their strength and their secret. And Jacob exhibits superhuman strength in his ability to hold on to the man. Especially frequent in these sagas is the notion that the effectiveness of these beings is bound to the nighttime. When morning breaks, they must disappear. And the man with whom Jacob struggles asks to be released as morning is coming. Now, ancient humans knew themselves to be surrounded by divine powers, which determined the course of their lives, but from whom they could not, by their own power, free themselves. In the old legends, it says that if one of these powers or spirits revealed themselves or became visible, then the most basic and urgent question was to ask it its name. For if you could discover that, then you could summon it by sacrifice or obligate it by conjuring with the divine power of its name. A name to the ancients was not simply a form of identification. It was the form of identification. For them, a name was closely linked to the bearer in such a way that the name contained something of the character of the one who bore it. Thus, in revealing his name to the man, Jacob reveals his whole nature. This unknown assailant knows him to be a cheat and a usurper. But even with full knowledge of Jacob's character, he does bless him. And Jacob's stolen blessing becomes legitimate. Yet the unknown assailant in this story of Jacob extricates himself from Jacob's grip. He does not give his name to Jacob when he demands it. He remains a mystery and counters with this question, which leads me to another part of the answer. This question: why is it that you wish to know my name? And this is one message of this story. It contains experiences of faith that extend from the most ancient periods, from the echoes of ancestors and customs long ago, but still lingering down to the time of the narrator. There is charged to it something of the result of the entire divine history into which Israel was drawn, and there is charged to it today something of the divine history of every age and every culture's understanding of God. And that is the meat of this matter. Tell us your name. We want to know God. We need some power over you. Give us your name. We need to know who you are so we can find a place for you to fit in our scheme of things. We need to know who you are so we know we are known. Now, it seems the ancient Hebrews resisted this need. They struggled and they wrestled just as we do. And one of their names for God was simply, I am. Why is this not sufficient for us? Why do we assign attributes and roles and responsibilities to this I am? What if we started instead with the assumption that we are fully known? What if we invited all our interactions with another, with the world, with prayer and praise and struggling and wrestling? What if we began with the assumption that we are fully known? And therefore know this I am. And that is the second part of the answer that I have come to in my journey. And what if we began each day with the premise that sufficient unto the day is the goodness thereof? Turning to Matthew and the story of the feeding of the 5,000 and turning to Jesus, what if we see this story not as some supernatural occurrence, bread and fish appearing from nowhere, a sort of modern equivalent of the manna from heaven in the time of the Exodus? What if we see this story as a lesson in the sufficiency of all created things, the sufficiency of creation? The 5,000 at first refusing to share what they had brought with them to eat as they listened for a word of hope from the preacher Jesus. And when they got it, when they felt that they knew in a moment that one would hope would multiply over a lifetime of decisions, collective and individual, what if they knew in that moment that they were fully known? What if somehow Jesus had imparted that to them or pointed them in that direction? What if they could rest in that assurance? What if Jesus, the preacher, managed to convey that to relay, to embody that? That is the miracle. Then they knew they had enough. And they knew they had enough to share. And so they did. And 5,000 were fed. The lessons we need to learn in kindergarten or Sunday school or at our parents' knee, sharing the connection of everything to every other thing, abundance, this is enough for all. Science and our younger folk are leading us in this. Black Lives Matter, reconciliation, the work of coming to that place of sufficiency, a place where all matter matters, where there is enough for all. This is the spirit work of the kingdom already here, already imbued with the power to be sufficient unto all days, unto all our days. The task of faith then becomes not the task of believing the unbelievable, but the task of living and loving and being all our days, of being the kingdom. We are fully known, and therefore we know I am. And we hear now Ben Stein sing, on this day that we mark Emancipation Day, part of that recognition, both of the kingdom's work done by Viola Desmond and Dr. King, the kingdom's work to be done, and the courage to do it. Amen. How long was that?